the free and showy circulation of Rumford around the grounds, unimpeded by crowds. It meant, too, that Rumford could offer a glimpse of himself to every person on the grounds. The system was not suspended magnetically, though it looked like a miracle of levitation. The seeming miracle was achieved by means of a cunning use of paint. The underpinnings were painted a flat black, while the superstructures were painted flashing gold. Television cameras and microphones on booms could follow the system anywhere. For night materializations, the superstructures of the system were outlined in flesh-colored electric lamps. The Space Wanderer was only the 31st person to be invited to join Rumford on the elevated system. An assistant had now been dispatched to the Malachi booth outside to bring in the 32nd and 33rd persons to share the eminence. Rumford did not look well. His color was bad. And, although he smiled as always, his teeth seemed to be gnashing behind the smile. His complacent glee had become a caricature, betraying the fact that all was not well by any means. But on and on the famous smile went. The magnificently snobbish crowd-pleaser held his big dog cassock by a choke chain. The chain was twisted so as to nip warningly into the dog's throat. The warning was necessary, since the dog plainly did not like the Space Wanderer. The smile faltered for an instant, reminding the crowd of what a load Rumford carried for them, warning the crowd that he might not be able to carry it forever. Rumford carried in his palm a microphone and transmitter the size of a penny. When he did not want his voice carried to the crowd, he simply smothered the penny in his fist. The penny was smothered in his fist now, and he was addressing bits of irony to the Space Wanderer that would have bewildered the crowd, had the crowd been able to hear them.
"This is certainly your day, isn't it?" said Rumford. "A perfect love feast from the instant you arrived. The crowd simply adores you. Do you adore crowds?"
The joyful shocks of the day had reduced the Space Wanderer to a childish condition, a condition wherein irony and even sarcasm were lost on him. He had been the captive of many things in his troubled times. He was now a captive of a crowd that thought he was a marvel. "They've certainly been wonderful," he said in reply to Rumford's last question. "They've been grand."
"Oh, they're a grand bunch," said Rumford. "No mistake about that. I've been racking my brains for the right word to describe them, and you've brought it to me from outer space. Grand is what they are."
Rumford's mind was plainly elsewhere. He wasn't much interested in the Space Wanderer as a person, hardly looked at him. Neither did he seem very excited about the approach of the Space Wanderer's wife and child.
"Where are they? Where are they?" said Rumford to an assistant below. "Let's get on with it. Let's get it over with."
The Space Wanderer was finding his adventures so satisfying and stimulating, so splendidly staged, that he was shy about asking questions, was afraid that asking questions might make him seem ungrateful. He realized that he had a terrific ceremonial responsibility, and that the best thing to do was to keep his mouth shut, to speak only when spoken to, and to make his answers to all questions short and artless. The Space Wanderer's mind did not teem with questions. The fundamental structure of his ceremonial situation was obvious. He was as clean and functional as a three-legged milking stool. He had suffered mightily, and now he was being rewarded mightily. The sudden change in fortunes made a bang-up show. He smiled, understanding the crowd's delight, pretending to be in the crowd himself, sharing the crowd's delight. Rumford read the Space Wanderer's mind.
"They'd like it just as much the other way around, you know," he said.
"The other way around?" said the Space Wanderer.
"If the big reward came first, and then the great suffering," said Rumford. "It's the contrast they like. The order of events doesn't make any difference to them. It's the thrill of the fast reverse."
Rumford opened his fist, exposed the microphone. With his other hand, he beckoned pontifically. He was beckoning to B and Chrono, who had been hoisted onto a tributary of the gilded system of catwalks, ramps, ladders, pulpits, steps, and stages.
"This way, please. We haven't got all day, you know," said Rumford schoolmarmishly.
During the lull, the space wanderer felt the first real tickle of plans for a good future on Earth, with everyone so kind and enthusiastic and peaceful. Not only a good life, but a perfect life could be lived on Earth. The space wanderer had already been given a fine new suit and a glamorous station in life, and his mate and son were to be restored to him in a matter of minutes. All that was lacking was a good friend, and the space wanderer began to tremble. He trembled, for he knew in his heart that his best friend, Stony Stevenson, was hidden somewhere on the grounds, awaiting a cue to appear. The space wanderer smiled, for he was imagining Stony's entrance. Stony would come running down a ramp, laughing and a little drunk.
"Onk, you bloody bastard!" Stony would roar right into the public address system. "By God, I've looked in every flaming pub on bloody Earth for you! And here you've been hung up on Mercury the whole bloody time!"
As B and Chrono reached Rumford and the Space Wanderer, Rumford walked away. Had he separated himself from B, Chrono, and the Space Wanderer by a mere arm's length, his separateness might have been understood. But the gilded system enabled him to put a really respectable distance between himself and the three. And not only a distance, but a distance made torturous by rococo and variously symbolic hazards. It was undeniably great theater, notwithstanding Dr. Maurice Rosenau's carping comment, "Opsit."
"The people who watch reverently as Winston Niles Rumford goes dancing over his golden jungle gym in Newport are the same idiots one finds in toy stores, gaping reverently at toy trains as the trains go chuffa-chuffa-chuffa in and out of papier-mâché tunnels, over toothpick trestles, through cardboard cities, and into papier-mâché tunnels again. Will the little trains, or will Winston Niles Rumford chuffa 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 into view again? Oh, mirabile dictu! They will!"
From the scaffold in front of the mansion, Rumford went to a stile that arched over the crest of a boxwood hedge. On the other side of the stile was a catwalk that ran for 10 feet to the trunk of a copper beech. The trunk was 4 feet through. Gilded rungs were fixed to the trunk by lag screws. Rumford tied Kazakh to the bottom rung, then climbed out of sight like Jack on the beanstalk. From somewhere up in the tree he spoke. His voice came not from the tree, but from the Gabriel horns on the walls. The crowd weaned its eyes from the leafy treetop, turned its eyes to the nearest loudspeakers. Only B, Chrono, and the Space Wanderer continued to look up at where Rumford really was. This wasn't so much a result of realism as it was a result of embarrassment. By looking up, the members of the little family avoided looking at each other. None of the three had any reason to be pleased with the reunion. B was not drawn to the scrawny, bearded, happy boob in lemon-yellow long underwear. She had dreamed of a big, angry, arrogant free thinker. Young Chrono hated the bearded intruder on his sublime relationship with his mother. Chrono kissed his good luck piece and wished that his father, if this really was his father, would drop dead. And the space wanderer himself, sincerely as he tried, could see nothing he would have chosen of his own free will in the dark, malevolent mother and son. By accident, the space wanderer's eyes met the one good eye of B. Something had to be said.
"How do you do?" said the space wanderer.
"How do you do?" said B.
They both looked up into the tree again.
"Oh, my happy handicapped brethren," said Rumford's voice. "Let us thank God, God who appreciates our thanks as much as the mighty Mississippi appreciates a raindrop, that we are not like Malachi Constant."
The back of the space wanderer's neck ached some. He lowered his gaze. His eyes were caught by a long, straight, golden runway in the middle distance. His eyes followed it. The runway ended at Earth's longest freestanding ladder. The ladder was painted gold, too. The space wanderer's gaze climbed the ladder to the tiny door of the spaceship on top of the column. He wondered who would have nerve enough or reason enough to climb such a frightening ladder to such a tiny door. The space wanderer looked at the crowd again. Maybe Stony Stevenson was in the crowd somewhere. Maybe he would wait for the whole show to end before he presented himself to his best and only friend from Mars. Chapter 11. We hate Malachi Constant because...
Tell me one good thing you ever did in your life.
Winston Niles Rumford. And this is how the sermon went.
We are disgusted by Malachi Constant, said Winston Niles Rumford on his treetop, because he used the fantastic fruits of his fantastic good luck to finance an unending demonstration that man is a pig. He wallowed in sycophants. He wallowed in worthless women. He wallowed in lascivious entertainments and alcohol and drugs. He wallowed in every known form of voluptuous turpitude. At the height of his good luck, Malachi Constant was worth more than the states of Utah and North Dakota combined. Yet, I dare say, his moral worth was not that of the most corrupt little field mouse in either state. We are angered by Malachi Constant, said Rumford in his treetop, because he did nothing to deserve his billions, and because he did nothing unselfish or imaginative with his billions. He was as benevolent as Marie Antoinette, as creative as a professor of cosmetology in an embalming college. We hate Malachi Constant, said Rumford up in his treetop, because he accepted the fantastic fruits of his fantastic good luck without a qualm, as though luck were the hand of God. To us of the Church of God the Utterly Indifferent, there is nothing more cruel, more dangerous, more blasphemous that a man can do than to believe that. That luck, good or bad, is the hand of God. Luck, good or bad, said Rumford up in his treetop, is not the hand of God. Luck, said Rumford up in his treetop, is the way the wind swirls and the dust settles, eons after God has passed by. Space Wanderer, called Rumford from up in his treetop.
The Space Wanderer was not paying strict attention. His powers of concentration were feeble, possibly because he had been in the caves too long, or on goofballs too long, or in the army of Mars too long. He was watching clouds. They were lovely things, and the sky they drifted in was, to the color-starved space wanderer, a thrilling blue.
Space Wanderer! Called Rumford again.
You in the yellow suit, said B.
She nudged him.
Wake up!
Pardon me? Said the space wanderer.
Space Wanderer! Called Rumford.
The space wanderer snapped to attention.
Yes, sir?
He called up into the leafy bower. The greeting was ingenuous, cheerful, and winsome. A microphone on the end of a boom was swung to dangle before him.
Space Wanderer!
Called Rumford, and he was peeved now, for the ceremonial flow was being impeded.
"Right here, sir,"
cried the space wanderer. His reply boomed ear-splittingly from the loudspeaker.
"Who are you?" said Rumford. "What is your real name?"
"I don't know my real name," said the space wanderer. "They called me Unk."
"What happened to you before you arrived back on Earth, Unk?" said Rumford.
The space wanderer beamed. He had been led to a repetition of the simple statement that had caused so much laughing and dancing and singing on Cape Cod.
"I was a victim of a series of accidents, as are we all," he said.
There was no laughing and dancing and singing this time, but the crowd was definitely in favor of what the space wanderer had said. Chins were raised, and eyes were widened, and nostrils were flared. There was no outcry, for the crowd wanted to hear absolutely everything that Rumford and the space wanderer might have to say.
"A victim of a series of accidents, were you?" said Rumford up in his treetop. "Of all the accidents," he said, "which would you consider the most significant?"
The space wanderer cocked his head.
"I'd have to think," he said.
"I'll spare you the trouble," said Rumford. "The most significant accident that happened to you was your being born. Would you like me to tell you what you were named when you were born?"
The space wanderer hesitated only a moment, and all that made him hesitate was a fear that he was going to spoil a very gratifying ceremonial career by saying the wrong thing.
"Please do," he said.
"They called you Malachi Constant," said Rumford, up in his treetop.
To the extent that crowds can be good things, the crowds that Winston Niles Rumford attracted to Newport were good crowds. They were not crowd-minded. The members remained in possession of their own consciences, and Rumford never invited them to participate as one in any action, least of all in applause or catcalls. When the fact had sunk in that the space wanderer was the disgusting, irking, and hateful Malachi Constant, the members of the crowd reacted in quiet, sighing, personal ways. Ways that were by and large compassionate. It was on their generally decent consciences, after all, that they had hanged Constant in effigy in their homes and places of work. And while they had been cheerful enough about hanging the effigies, very few felt that Constant, in the flesh, actually deserved hanging. Hanging Malachi Constant in effigy was an act of violence on the order of trimming a Christmas tree or hiding Easter eggs. And Rumford, up in his treetop, said nothing to discourage their compassion.
"You have had the singular accident, Mr. Constant," he said sympathetically, "of becoming a central symbol of wrong-headedness for a perfectly enormous religious sect. You would not be attractive to us as a symbol, Mr. Constant," he said, "if our hearts did not go out to you to a certain extent. Our hearts have to go out to you, since all of your flamboyant errors are errors that human beings have made since the beginning of time." "In a few minutes, Mr. Constant," said Rumford up in his treetop, "you are going to walk down the catwalks and ramps to that long golden ladder. And you are going to climb that ladder. And you are going to get into that spaceship. And you are going to fly away to Titan, a warm and fecund moon of Saturn. You will live there in safety and comfort, but in exile from your native Earth. You are going to do this voluntarily, Mr. Constant, so that the Church of God the Utterly Indifferent can have a drama of dignified self-sacrifice to remember and ponder through all time. We will imagine, to our spiritual satisfaction,
said Rumford up in his treetop,
"that you are taking all mistaken ideas about the meaning of luck, all misused wealth and power, and all disgusting pastimes with you."
The man who had been Malachi Constant, who had been Unk, who had been the Space Wanderer, the man who was Malachi Constant again, that man felt very little upon being declared Malachi Constant again. He might, possibly, have felt some interesting things, had Rumford's timing been different. But Rumford told him what his ordeal was to be only seconds after telling him he was Malachi Constant. And the ordeal was sufficiently ghastly to command Constant's full attention. The ordeal had been promised not in years or months or days, but in minutes. And, like any condemned criminal, Malachi Constant became a student, to the exclusion of all else, of the apparatus on which he was about to perform. Curiously, his first worry was that he would stumble, that he would think too hard about the simple matter of walking, and that his feet would cease to work naturally, and that he would stumble on those wooden feet.
"You won't stumble, Mr. Constant," said Rumford up in his treetop, reading Constant's mind. "There is nowhere else for you to go, nothing else for you to do. By putting one foot in front of the other, while we watch in silence, you will make yourself the most memorable, magnificent, and meaningful human being of modern times."
Constant turned to look at his dusky mate and child. Their gazes were direct. Constant learned from their gazes that Rumford had spoken the truth, that no course save the course to the spaceship was open to him. Beatrice and young Crono were supremely cynical about the festivities, but not about courageous behavior in the midst of them. They dared Malachi Constant to behave well. Constant rubbed his left thumb and index finger together in a careful rotary motion. He watched this pointless enterprise for perhaps 10 seconds, and then he dropped his hands to his sides, raised his eyes, and stepped off firmly toward the spaceship. As his left foot struck the ramp, his head was filled with a sound he had not heard for 3 earthling years. The sound was coming from the antenna under the crown of his skull. Rumford, up in his treetop, was sending signals to Constant's antenna by means of a small box in his pocket. He was making Constant's long and lonely walk more bearable by filling Constant's head with the sound of a snare drum. The snare drum had this to say to him: "Rented a tent, a tent, a tent, rented a tent, a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent, rented a tent." The snare drum fell silent as Malachi Constant's hand closed for the first time on a gilded rung of the world's tallest freestanding ladder. He looked up, and the perspective made the ladder's summit seem as tiny as a needle. Constant rested his brow for a moment against the rung to which his hand clung.
"You have something you would like to say, Mr. Constant, before you go up the ladder?" said Rumford up in his treetop.
A microphone on the end of a boom was again dangled before Constant. Constant licked his lips.
"You're about to say something, Mr. Constant?" said Rumford.
"If you're going to talk," the technician in charge of the microphone said to Constant, "speak in a perfectly normal tone, and keep your lips about 6 inches away from the microphone."
"You're going to speak to us, Mr. Constant?" said Rumford.
It's probably not worth saying," said Constant quietly. "But I'd still like to say that I haven't understood a single thing that's happened to me since I reached Earth."
"You haven't got that feeling of participation?"
said Rumford up in his treetop.
"Is that it?"
"It doesn't matter," said Constant. "I'm still going up the ladder."
"Well," said Rumford up in his treetop, "if you feel we are doing you some sort of injustice here,
Suppose you tell us something really good you've done at some point in your life, and let us decide whether that piece of goodness might excuse you from this thing we have planned for you.
Goodness, said Constant.
Yes, said Rumford expansively. Tell me one good thing you ever did in your life. What you can remember of it.
Constant thought hard. His principal memories were of scuttling through endless corridors in the caves. There had been a few opportunities for what might pass for goodness with Boaz and the Harmoniums, but Constant could not say honestly that he had availed himself of these opportunities to be good. So he thought about Mars, about all the things that had been contained in his letter to himself. Surely, among all those items, there was something about his own goodness. And then he remembered Stony Stevenson, his friend. He had had a friend, which was certainly a good thing.
I had a friend, said Malachi Constant into the microphone.
What was his name? Said Rumford.
Stony Stevenson, said Constant.
Just one friend?
Said Rumford up in his treetop.
Just one, said Constant.
His poor soul was flooded with pleasure as he realized that one friend was all that a man needed in order to be well supplied with friendship.
So your claim of goodness would stand or fall, really, said Rumford up in his treetop, depending on how good a friend you really were of this Stony Stevenson.
Yes, said Constant.
Do you recall an execution on Mars, Mr. Constant? Said Rumford, up in his treetop. Wherein you were the executioner? You strangled a man at the stake before three regiments of the Army of Mars.
This was one memory that Constant had done his best to eradicate. He had been successful to a large extent, and the rummaging he did